Okay. Well, good morning, and we are continuing in John chapter 7. So if you want to turn there, last week we were halfway through the first 13 verses, and we're going to continue starting with, in our discussion with verse 7, but for this first part of the class, let's reread those first 13 verses, and then after we've worked our way through that, we'll pick it up at verse 14 and begin another passage if there's time today. Another longer teaching from Jesus, a discourse, his interaction at the temple, and we'll just see how far we get. So if someone could read John 7, 1 through 13, then we'll do our remainder of the discussion over that part of the passage. So last time we talked about his brothers and even looked at other passages to see them by name. Jesus' brothers are encouraging him to go up to the feast, not because they believed in him. Scriptures tell us that clearly. But out of their unbelief, though, they're prodding him on to go up to the feast, because if you want to be somebody important, somebody seen, somebody known publicly, that's what you should do. And Jesus responded to them, "No, my time's not yet here." We know when he says "my time," that he's referring to the time of the crucifixion, the time to end his ministry as the walking personification of God, the actual being of God in a skin. He will be here some after the crucifixion as the risen Savior, but not long. So it's time to do that, to make the sacrificial death on the cross just isn't there. He criticizes them in verse 6, "My time is not here, but your time is always opportune." We talked about how, you know, God has a definite plan, but these folks are just out willy-nilly, just doing whatever comes to mind at the time. And of course, you know, they don't have the motivation that Jesus does out of their unbelief. Verse 7 is where we're going to pick it up. It says, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its deeds are evil." What do you think Jesus was telling his brothers in this statement? The world cannot hate you, but it hates me. Why can't the world hate his brothers? They're of the world. Yeah, they're not going to hate his brothers, because his brothers are a part of it. They're a part of this worldliness that is trying to push Jesus in a particular direction. And, of course, interestingly enough, over time, when Jesus does go to the cross, the Pharisees think they did it, along with the rest of the Jewish people who followed them. But in reality, Jesus makes it clear. He lays his life down and he can take it up again. So that's what the world is trying to do. They're trying to force his hand. They're trying to take him to a place that he doesn't want to go, out of God's timing. And So the world won't hate his brothers because they're just being a part of that. Jesus says, but it does hate him. Why? Why does Jesus say the world hates him? Well, it is, but he's a little more specific in this case. If you look at the last half of verse 7.
He's pointing out your sinfulness.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, the world hates him. One, the reason he cites here, it goes beyond this. The world is just outright rebellious to God. But in this case, what he cites is, I'm pointing out their evil deeds. They don't appreciate it. They hate me for it. You know, once again, this theme that is developing it, for me personally at least, is that Jesus' conflict with these folks wasn't because they didn't understand him. It's because they did. He was making it very clear how evil they were, and they didn't have a good response to that. They couldn't prove him wrong. They couldn't even provide good evidence that he was wrong, so the only course left is confrontation and hate or agreement, and they weren't inclined to go with understanding their depravity and agree with Jesus in that. Do you have a thought you wanted to share? No?
Well, I've just been sitting here thinking that this speaks very loudly of predestination, but yet our responsibility in him.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, taking on the responsibility to stay away from the Jews until it's God's time. And
yep.
How hard it is for us to see what's our will and what's God's will in our life.
Yeah, it's one of those very challenging things to try to get our understanding around, isn't it? Other thoughts or comments so far? Okay, so verse 8, he says, go up to the feast yourselves. I don't go up to the feast because my time is not yet fully come. And having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee. So Jesus says to his brothers, you go on. It's not my time yet. And so they go ahead and he stays. But he doesn't stay very long, does he? Because in verse 10, when his brothers gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. So the Jews were seeking him at the feast and were saying, where is he? There was much grumbling amongst the crowds and so on. So what does Jesus do? He waits back and he goes on his own, and it kind of comes in an unseen way and enters the feast without fanfare and without being the center of attention for a while. It's very interesting, isn't it? As a matter of fact, if you look at this, when we see in verse 11, it says, so the Jews were seeking them. Remember what that means when we read the book of John? Who are the Jews?
Pharisees,
the Jewish leaders, the leaders of the temple, the political heads of the Jewish nation. So the Jewish leaders are looking for him. And it's implied that his going in secrecy, we don't know that it's a hatched out plan between his brothers and the Jewish leaders. I mean, we don't know that it was an open kind of a thing, but he clearly, that was what he was avoiding, was the confrontation managed on their grounds. Because he's going to have a confrontation with them. It's intentional on his part. He's never surprised by these things that occur, but he's not going to let his brothers march him into town and make a big fanfare of it. That's outside of what he intends to accomplish at the Feast of the Tabernacles. So he's not going to do it their way because his time hasn't yet come, so he does it in the way that's a part of his planned ministry. And we even see that the Jews were anticipating his arrival, the Jews, the Jewish leaders, and were looking for him and even asking, where is he? Yes.
Mm-hmm. He turns around going. It's like this, you know, kind of a quiet line, sort of.
Well, and I mean, I look at this just a little bit different than that when I read it. I look at it, I'm not going up to this feast almost with you. I'm not going to take your plan to go to the feast. My time hasn't yet come. In other words, their way of doing it, and you can even see it in their own words. If you want to be a public figure, you need to go stand in the main square and attract all the attention you can. He says, I'm not going to the feast that way. And he doesn't use the words that way or whatever, but he sends them to the feast on their own, and then he does it his own way. And you know, I don't want to. I mean, I can't say more than what words are here, but that's kind of the way I look at it. Is I'm not going to go with you, rather than I'm not going at all ever. Don't know if that's the right way to look at these words or not, from a, just a linguistic standpoint, but that's what I get out of it. Thank you. Good question. Other thoughts or questions?
We're comparing our things. I've got the King James, and it says, I go not up yet
yep.
to this feast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I, you know, I don't know the. I honestly I didn't study that one out. I mean, it wouldn't be too difficult. We know that there's a time element in that in those words there. I do not go up to this feast because my time is not yet fully come. Is the way it says in the New American Standard. You know, sometimes those time things you have to really work to parse them out in the Greek piece to see how the time element fits in, and I didn't do that, so I can't add anything there. But maybe no, don't see anything more in the notes that I have here. Oh, wait a minute. No, I don't have anything more I can add.
He's
from
responding to their intent, which
right.
their intent was to bring focus on him, and if he would have gone as the entourage went, they would have made sure the focus would have been on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's a pretty clear question in scriptures here.
Yeah, he would have never probably, I mean, in a worldly sense, Jesus is always going to get to do what he plans to do. But in a worldly sense, you know, it may not have even allowed him to get to the to the things that were intended to happen as he interacted with the crowd here that we're going to see. So, good. Any other comments or thoughts? Okay, so they're looking for him in verse 11. Where is he? There was much grumbling among the crowds concerning him. Some were saying he's a good man, and others were saying, no, on the contrary, he leads the people astray. Yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews. Let's start with verse 13, then we'll go back to 12. So what does verse 13 tell us about how the crowds are handling their curiosity, their grumbling, their own debates about Jesus? How are they, what's the nature of that? What's the style of their handling that?
It seems that they are curious, some of them, in a positive manner, not such a positive manner, but they definitely don't want the Jewish leaders' attention on them for fear of being accused of being associated.
Yeah, the atmosphere in Jerusalem at the Feast of the Tabernacles is tense regarding Jesus. He's the topic of discussion, and as Barry said, the people in their discussions don't really want the Jewish leadership to get involved in that with them. So you've got the crowds having their own discussion, working hard to keep that separate from the Jewish leaders. And in their discussions, according to verse 12, there's a couple of different views there. One is he's a good man, and others, he leads people astray. Which of those two is right? That's a trick question to some extent. Neither one ultimately completely. Obviously, what's that? Obviously, he's a good man is true. Jesus was good. As a matter of fact, you could almost say he's the only good man. But when you emphasize the word man, there is a limitation there. We don't know what they meant by it. If they meant he's a man with God's being in him, then that's probably okay. But in all probability, they're probably arguing over him, much like some would argue today. Jesus was a good guy. He had some really good teachings. Don't believe he was raised from the dead. Don't, you know, you know what the kinds of things in the world. And so it could have been that kind of an argument, both sides being fairly worldly. Maybe his true disciples, there weren't very many of those though by this point. Most everybody had left but the 12. So it's unlikely he had some fully understanding followers around. There probably were some because we know Lazarus was out there and they might have been there. So maybe, we don't really know. Maybe they were really promoting Jesus in an accurate way about his own being and what he was doing. It's interesting in these words what's missing in the Jewish context and why I tend to think neither side really is very good, very correct. Because what's missing? What were the Jews looking for? Messiah. We don't hear them saying, he's Messiah. No, he's not. We hear them saying, he's a good man. No, he's not. So, for whatever that's worth.
Isn't this just a continuation of what did we talked about the apostles feeling last week? They were very confused. And, where else can we go?
Yep.
They understood a lot more than the crowd did. The crowd's very confused. You know, they thought he was going to be the Messiah. He doesn't want to be the Messiah, so,
Well, he wants to be the Messiah, but not the Messiah they were dreaming of. So I think that is a continuation of that and continues right up through what's going to come in a few months, which is his crucifixion. So they were having this grumbling. As of yet, we haven't seen Jesus' presence even noted, and he is still the topic of discussion. But verse 1. So that's our transition from what we to now what we're going to continue on with today. So Jesus kind of waited until the feast is in the middle of its celebration before he began to teach. So let's pick it up. Let's start with verse 14 and read through 24. Who would do that for us, please? Thank you, Marlon.
Now in the midst of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple and began to teach. The Jews, therefore, were marveling, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? Jesus, therefore, answered them and said, my teaching is not mine, but he is who sent me. If any man is willing to do his will, he shall know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak from myself. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carry out the law? Why do you seek to kill me? The multitude answered, you have a demon. Who seeks to kill you? Jesus answered and said to them, I did one deed, and you all marveled. On this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the
starts teaching, the Jews have a reaction, and from the reaction we get an interruption. Before we look, just to lay the groundwork to understand maybe a little bit more what it was like to be in the position of the Jews, I would like to ask you, we've studied 7 chapters of John. There's a lot of John left to go, but so far Jesus has made a lot of claims about himself. And I don't expect everybody to remember all those, but what are some of the claims you can remember Jesus made about himself? His attributes, his role, his function, his person, so far in the book of John that you can pull out of memory. Okay, Son of God. That's a one for sure.
Selflessness. He's not here to do his will, but the will of God.
Okay.
Came from him.
Uh-huh. created life. The words that we would see if we look back a little bit was even the giver of life. Same thing, but that's kind of how it was said a little more. What else?
He's the truth.
Okay.
Basically, he is the Messiah.
Said he was Messiah.
Bread of life.
Uh-huh, bread of life. See, I've got a cheat. I got a list.
Exclusive way to God.
Okay. Others?
He's the man of the Sabbath.
What do you mean by that? Ruler of the Sabbath? Okay. Yeah. There's a better word somewhere, and I don't know what it is, so this one will work. Living water. Yeah, we've done a pretty good job. He is. One to raise everyone in the last days. He's also sovereign judge. Remember, he's talking about God giving all judgment over to him. That's a pretty good list. And most of these things he'd said in when there were big crowds around and would be fairly well known. And there's probably more that he's already claimed. So here's the Jews. The Jewish nation, not just leadership, that made their mind up. You got the Jewish nation out there reckoning with them. And this is a lot of things to have claimed by this point in his ministry. That, you know, if somebody stood in front of us today and made all these claims, you know, we're reckoning with. And we're either going to decide that he's a nut, outright, thoroughly, completely, or... if we were to determine that the scriptures say, no, he is something else, which isn't going to happen in our day, but the Messiah had yet come in their day, had not yet come, at least recognized. So, you know, they had a lot to reckon with there. So he began teaching. And what I want to show you in these next few verses is how these things point to the validity of his claims and the truth of who he is. So let's start out looking at verse 15. The Jews then were astonished, saying, "How has this man become learned, having never been educated?" So what's the argument of the Jews here? Well, they're astonished. And they're going, "Wow, what's going on here?" And so what issue are they raising?
Well, they didn't teach him.
Yeah, his educational credentials. He's talking, obviously, we don't even know what he said. We don't get to be told what he was telling them at the Feast of the Tabernacles. But whatever it was, they were going, "Wow, this guy's really putting it together. He's speaking with clarity and authority and so on." And so here they are looking at that, going, you know, where does this come from? Jesus has an answer in verse 16. What is his answer? It's from God. Yeah, you're right. I haven't been educated, except God's just given this to me to give to you. I'm a messenger here. God gave me the message. I'm bringing it to you. And I and God are ones a part of this. But the fact that he is bringing this kind of detail and whatever it was, the content of this message to them in an astonishing way says, and no education, says, number one, he is God. But also then validates the truth of what he's saying. Where else do we see the people astonished at the style of Jesus' teaching? Verse 12. When he's 12 years old at the temple. The money changers. There's another one that's really, really, when he gave the Sermon on the Mount, the people were awed because he spoke with authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes and the Pharisees had a tendency to say, well, you know, this stuff is soft. Who really knows? And there are some things they brought about the Lord, but they tended to not be one who brought the Word of God with authority. And so Jesus has done that. He spoke with authority. He said to them, I tell you, rather than, well, look at this and look at that, and from this we can see that. And so it was very direct and very open. And the same thing as Marlon brought out when he was 12 years old and he was off with the learned men in the temple, and he astonished them with what he knew. So God was pouring out on him the understanding and fullness of what there was to know, and he was God, so it makes sense. I wasn't planning on bringing this particular aspect up, but it was common for rabbis who were considered teachers. I'm sorry. It was common for, rabbis, and rabbi means teacher. But it was common for Jewish teachers to come, and their style was they would sit down what we would call Indian style. They'd just find an open area in the temple, sit down Indian style. That was a signal that, hey, I'm here, I'm going to teach. People would gather around and listen to them teach. If they were pretty well known, they could quickly draw a crowd. If they weren't very well known, somebody might stop by and watch them a little bit, listen a little bit. If they were attracted, they might stay, otherwise move on. So actually, it was pretty much, how do I want to say this? It was open game for those who were perceived to be teachers. I don't know if somebody like me walked in and had tried it, I don't know what they would have done. They might have said, get out of here, you know. But it was kind of an open game for those that were rabbinical in nature. Anybody have any information to talk more about how it was restrictive or not? Okay. So Jesus told them, the teaching isn't mine, but is him who sent me. Verse 17, if anyone is willing to do his will, he will know the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak of myself, from myself. This is another very telling statement by Jesus. Who is going to believe the truth of what Jesus is saying? Right, according to that verse. What's that? Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate, but really it would be better said, those who will, in other words, out of themselves to do the will of, I don't know, does it say Father or God? But anyway, it's those that intend, based on the way these words are in the Greek, those who intend to do the will of God are the ones who are going to believe him. In other words, it's not just those who inadvertently do it, but it's out of their own intentional determination to do the will of God, they do it. They're the ones that are going to understand. And see, that isn't how we expect things to work in our world, is it? Who do we expect to know and understand truth based on the way the world works? The teachers would. Those that are educated, those, you know, the geniuses, we expect them to put all the pieces together and come up with an answer. Those that have maybe worldly experience. I mean, there's a lot of things that we think come out of our attributes, our abilities to perceive is where we think people are going to discover the truth, knowledge, wisdom, and so on. But Jesus said, no, it's not out of your ability to perceive that you're going to discover the truth here. It's going to be out of your intentional setting out to do the will of God. Out of that, you're going to discover and know the truth and be able to discern that out of what he's teaching, and you'll know that his teaching is all true. Questions, comments so far? So one of the main arguments so far, we would say, is because Jesus was uneducated, his source of information for this astonishing teaching had to be God the Father, making it true. In verse 17, he goes on to say, this person will know whether it's of God or whether I speak for myself. And then in verse 18, he says, he who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. What's Jesus' argument here about the truth of his teaching and claims about who he is and the rest of what he's brought to them?
He's not doing it for self-promotion.
Right. He's not doing it for something he's personally planning to get out of it. You know, the logic is, you know, you don't walk into the enemy camp and tell them all they're a bunch of idiots, you know, just so you can die at their sword. That's not the idea. You know, if you're going to do something for your own benefit, you're going to do things that are not only safe, but somehow bring you something that you intend to get out of it. And Jesus says, that's not what I'm about. I'm here to glorify the Father. I'm here to do what the Father's told me to do. I'm just the messenger in the sense of, that wasn't a good way of saying it. But you know, he's following the will of God as it was laid out before he ever came. And we know what he's going to get out of it, don't we? He's going to take the wrath of God upon himself on the cross. I mean, this isn't exactly something that you would do for your own personal glory or money or whatever. And so, and in that sense, he's also providing some criticism of the Pharisees and the Jews. Remember why the money changers, they're running a pretty profitable game for themselves. They also are the ones that get all the allocates from the local populace. They're seen as the righteous ones, as the wonderful people of our society, the leading leaders of the community. And so Jesus says, you know, he's making an unstated contrast here, but he's doing it for the God who sent him, and there's no unrighteousness there. He goes on in verse 19, did Moses give you the law, yet none of you carries it out? That's a pretty good blast at him. Why do you seek to kill me? That's an interesting couple of verses to put together. How does that fit into this? Moses gave you the law. You don't do it. Why are you wanting to kill me? How does that fit in with Moses' law?
Thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not kill. Yeah, and not only that, that's not the only thing they're not doing. He's pointing out that they have a heart problem, but it even is carried out in that they would like to murder. So how does the crowd answer? How do they respond to his, why do you want to kill me? Yeah, you have a demon. Who seeks to kill you? Does Jesus answer that question directly? I mean, he just kind of, he goes on from there. But it's interesting. And what are the possibilities here? What's one possibility for their response? Well, he knew their intent. I mean, he did know their intent.
And they were marveled at it.
Yeah, one is that this crowd does really intend to kill him. The people he's talking to. And they're denying it, just saying you're nuts. I mean, that is a fairly common response when somebody, when one person nabs another in a place they shouldn't be. Oh no, no, you're crazy. I didn't do that. I don't think that. I don't believe that. I'm not a part of that. Peter did it, didn't he? I mean, that's what Peter did when he denied Christ. Oh no, 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 I'm not one of them. And so that might be what's happening here. The other thing is, it may not have actually applied to some of the people listening. I mean, the plot to kill Jesus does exist. The Jews, the leaders of the Jewish community, are seeking to kill him. But the people may not have been a part of that yet. They have yet to go into the streets and yell, crucify him. As a matter of fact, they're going to have that Hosanna moment first. So, you know, we don't really know here. There may have been some people who really did not want to kill him. This may have been his way of pointing out to them, there are some of you here that do want to kill me, meaning the Jewish leaders and some others. So Jesus answered them and said, I did one deed and you all marvel. What's the one deed he did? What was the deed that caused him to, that he did right before he left the area of Jerusalem with the Jews wanting to kill him? Do you remember?
Healed the
paralytic on the Sabbath. Exactly right. So he's referring back to that one deed. I did probably, almost certainly, I did one deed and you all marvel. For this reason Moses has given you circumcision, not because it's from Moses, but from the fathers, and on the Sabbath you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so the law of Moses will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made the entire man well on the Sabbath? What's the logic of Jesus' argument here?
He's saying that according to Mosaic law, you are basically required to circumcise a child on the eighth day, and if it falls on the Sabbath, well, you're not breaking the law, so I healed. I'm not breaking the law.
Yeah. The circumcision is a bodily act prescribed by, we would say, the law, and he even points out, really didn't come from Moses, it came from Abraham. But it is in Leviticus, the eighth day, but it was really carried forward from Abraham's time. That Abraham instituted circumcision at God's direction, continued through Moses, and he says, hey, if he happens to hit on the Sabbath, it happens to hit on the Sabbath. So you can do a circumcision on the Sabbath, but you're against somebody being healed on the Sabbath? Making the whole body well, and that's really an argument from the lesser to the greater. You know, the circumcision isn't as much benefit, yes, and its alignment with God and His kingdom. It's the sign of your allegiance to God as a Jew. But, you know, here I made a whole man well on the Sabbath. Verse 24, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. What's he calling them to do? What's Jesus asking these people in the crowd to do?
Not to be people-pleasers, to be logical.
Well, we would say logical, but you almost could take a step back and say even be in tune with the whole of God's law, God's Word. Be in tune with the nature of God, the leading of God's Holy Spirit. He's telling them, bring righteousness into your judgment. Where the Jews were living, and we've talked about it many times, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, where they were living was outwardly. Righteousness comes from the heart. This outward expression of activities that were intended to say, hey, I've done all the right things. When Nicodemus came to Jesus and said, I'm sorry, when the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and Jesus says to him, you know, well, follow the commandments. And what's his answer? I've done them all. Jesus says, oh, really? Sell everything you've got. Let's start there. And, you know, he doesn't was very happy with that because his heart was not aligned. Maybe in outwardly things, he was letting nothing else be more important than God. But when it came to his heart, he had a problem because that stuff was pretty important to him. We don't know what he did. We don't know how he responded ultimately, But he certainly wasn't pleased with what Jesus gave him for a response, because he went away troubled for his, because he was a very wealthy man. So what we see going on here is Jesus is saying, bring righteous judgment. He didn't ask for do good works. He's aiming at their heart so they're thinking about the righteousness of God, the person of God, and the truth of who Jesus is. And, you know, you can do the right thing for the wrong reasons and not be anywhere you should be at all. You can also do the wrong thing thinking it's the right thing and really be in a bind. And that's what he's telling them to do here, is stop and look at what's going on. You've got a problem that I healed a man. And nobody argued where his power came from. So you've got a problem with me acting on behalf of God with his direction to heal a man on the Sabbath. But you don't have any problem over here with doing a circumcision. What is messed up with you? That's effectively what he's saying. You lack righteousness. You lack a righteous understanding in how you're living life. How do we get caught in those same traps? This is an easy place to live. How do we get caught in those same kinds of things? Legalism. Yeah, we get hung up on things. We pick certain things that cause us to feel justified. Yeah, I used to cuss a lot. I took all that out of my vocabulary, so now I'm a pretty good person. And you might be, and that's a good thing to do, but what's going on in the heart? Is there righteousness in the heart? Are you approaching the things of life with righteous judgment? And so you could go through any of those kinds of things. I go to church every Sunday. I teach a Sunday school class. I mean, I could go through my whole life and make a list of things that I do, that I feel like I'm serving God when I do them, and I hope that I am. But what really becomes important is, what is my heart aimed at? And we can use those things to distract us from dealing with the issues of our heart. These folks had a heart issue. They were very happy being God's chosen people. They were very happy feeling like they were the only really truly important people on the eyes and this planet in the eyes of God. They had a promised land from God. Nobody else had. They had the promise that David's kingdom would be restored and would last forever. They had all these things that would let them build up pride about who they were as Jews, but their hearts were self-centered, not God-centered.
I think another aspect is that people have a tendency to make judgments on things that they see without knowing the truth behind something. Mm-hmm. I give you a perfect example that makes me think of like it happened yesterday. But it's been a long time ago. A man in this town, by the name of Courtney Elder, was diagnosed with cancer. He died of cancer. So the only place I knew to find him and talk to him was at Elder's liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember walking in there and talking to him. I'm thinking, some people see me come in here, I'm sure they will judge me mm-hmm. for entering the liquor store and yet not knowing the facts. And to me, I think we all have a tendency to do that, and I think that's just a warning against that. I mean, we see things happen even within this body of believers, and we make judgments on what we see and not knowing. But I think that's
it can happen. You know, we misjudge what we see around us. And there's really, isn't there? There is that side, and it's very real. It's real easy to draw wrong conclusions. It's also very, very easy for those of us that have something we need to deal with to distract ourselves with other things. And so both of those are very important.
A lot of that righteousness, not being legalistic. Verse 18. And if what you're doing doesn't
Yep.
That's not righteous.
Yeah, it's kind of like the prayer between the Pharisee and the publican. Glorifies himself, and the other one just says, "God, you are holy, and I'm not, and I need your cleansing."